Today's CEC Preliminary Assessment and Site Inspection, or PASI, webinar. My name is Jean Fallon, and I will carry on in just one moment. We are going to continue on with today's webinar series with module number 9. This is the 9th and final module in the series on focusing on SI sampling strategies for soil and air. That seminar is going to conclude this multi-part webinar series that we've been hosting on Kluin for the past 2 months, and we'll provide a few instructions for those of you that were looking to receive a training certificate if you've attended all 9 modules in the series in just a moment. I'm going to turn things over to your instructors, Jody McCarty and Therese Joya from Tetra Tech, Inc. in just a minute, and once they do so, they'll kick off the technical portion today. But before we do that, let me walk through just a few basic housekeeping items and important reminders for today's session. Today's seminar is going to be run as the others in the series, so if you're familiar with it, I'll walk through this pretty quickly, but for those that might be brand new, I'm just going to ask you to first refer back to a registration or reminder email that you should have for today's live broadcast. This seminar was originally scheduled for July 31st, and we had to postpone it. So if you have multiple emails in your inbox, don't worry about which date they say. The instructions, the links, the call-in numbers are all exactly the same. So regardless of which email you have for module number 9, just make sure you click a button or link that says that refers you back to something called the seminar homepage, where you can read more about today's session, find contact information for our instructors. There will also be links to additional resources where you can download the slides, and also links to our short feedback form, which you can fill out after today's live broadcast. For now, you want to click a button that appears in the upper left-hand corner labeled Go to Seminar, and that'll check you in online to our fully interactive Adobe Connect delivery. Using this tool, you'll be able to watch and listen in real time as our presenters advance through materials live from their respective locations. If you have problems joining us online through Adobe Connect, you can simply download the slides. Again, they're posted under the Resources or Links area, and follow along on the phone lines. But just know you might miss out on a few interactive components, so we encourage you to let us know if you're having problems so we can try to troubleshoot those for you. Audio is available two ways. By default, everyone can listen to this session online through your computer speakers or using a pair of headphones if you've got a mobile device. If you have any problems with that online audio, I'll first encourage you to check your local volume settings. Sometimes you actually have to go into the sound control panel and increase your speaker output. If that doesn't solve the problem, some people say that using headphones can help. If you're hearing an echo, you may have accidentally joined the webinar twice, so try closing the webinar room and see if you find another instance of it running in the background. If all else fails, you can always ask for the call-in number in the Q&A window in the lower right-hand corner, and we'll be more than happy to give you that information. Just know if you join us on the phone lines, we will globally mute all callers, and we ask that you remain globally muted to cut down on background noises and other audio disruptions. There is an interactive Q&A pod that appears in the lower right corner of your screen. There's already a welcome message from me in there. That pod can be used to submit comments, questions, as well as to report technical problems at any time. We will take breaks for questions and answers with our instructors, and we encourage you guys to type up your comments and questions at any point. There's no need to wait. As soon as they occur to you, type them up. If you can include a slide number or title reference in your question to help understand the basis of it, that's certainly helpful. And again, at designated points, we'll take a break and I'll read through those questions so the instructors can answer them out loud. And this event is being recorded, as we have with the others in the series. We will automatically share a link to replay the recording as soon as we go through and process that archive by email with everyone who signs up. Hopefully you all have been receiving the automated emails. We do have, I believe, all 8 modules in this series archived and available for free replay. If you've missed any of those modules, you can certainly send me an email or send in a question in the Q&A, and I can get you direct links to each one of the module recordings in the series, as well as the feedback form for each one. You can also browse the public archive, where you'll find those previously recorded modules and nearly 600 other sessions online through our Kluin archive. So again, you should see a window on the left side showing a copy of the presentation materials. We will click through those slides for you, so if you want to page through at your own pace, I encourage you to download a copy and either print them out or just have them available at your end from the seminar resources or links page. You'll see our Cluin logo in the upper right, a collection of related URLs. Those are all active hyperlinks. You can click on any one of those and then press the Browse To button to open up those websites locally. And then, of course, our interactive Q&A window, which appears in the lower right-hand corner. You can type up your comments and questions in the empty box at the bottom, either hit Enter or press the bubble button to the right, and that'll privately submit your message in. As I mentioned earlier, this is the ninth module in a whole series that has been hosted as part of our CEC Preliminary Assessment and Site Inspection Training. To receive a special training certificate, which we usually don't do for Cluin webinars, but we are for this particular series, you will need to complete all nine modules, and we are suggesting, if at all possible, you do that in numerical order. But if we've gotten all the way here to module number nine, and there was a previous module in the series that you haven't completed yet, you will want to go back and replay whatever module you either didn't stay on live for or were unable to complete live. Whether you do them all recorded or some combination of live and recorded, it doesn't matter, but you need to take all nine modules as well as submit feedback for all nine modules in order to receive full credit for participating. So when you fill out your feedback form, we'll go through this again at the end of today's session. There's a box you can check on that form to ask for a confirmation email that you yourself will immediately receive when you submit the feedback form. So you can hang on to that, and if we don't issue a certificate, if you have that confirmation email, that helps us go back and update our records correctly to make sure we give you credit and we can issue a certificate. If you are missing any modules, if you are missing any feedback forms, if you have any questions about the sessions you think you've taken, the things you haven't, how to submit feedback, feel free to send in questions in the Q&A window, as well as to send an email to me directly at balance.jean@epa.gov. I think that's the end of the technical reminder for today's session in terms of housekeeping. So I'm going to get ready to turn things over to your instructors today to kick off today's module number nine. Your first instructor is going to be Jody McCarty, who's joining you from Tetra Tech, Inc. Jody, whenever you're ready to begin.
Thank you, Jean. All right, well, we'll go ahead and get started. Today, Module 9 is going to discuss sampling strategies for the soil exposure pathway and the air migration pathway. And we'll start off first with the soil exposure pathway. So what we're hoping to have you guys learn today is how to sample to demonstrate and observe to demonstrate observed contamination in the soil exposure pathway, how to establish the level of contamination, how to demonstrate attribution back to the site, how to identify your targets and then establish the distances from the contamination area, and then how to appropriately infer contamination. And then we'll end the soil exposure pathway sampling strategies with just a little case study example that we have. So first of all, in the soil exposure pathway, our first, our primary objective when we're sampling is to really identify if our targets, which are our residential, school, daycare, or workplace properties, are contaminated. And then also to evaluate that the targets exist on those areas of contamination or that those targets will travel to those different areas. When we're sampling for the soil exposure pathway, we're not looking at the likelihood that that hazardous substance is going to be released and migrate to the targets. We're making sure that it actually is, that we do have contamination in those areas of contamination and that the targets are on them or will travel to those areas. So when you're putting your sampling plan together and thinking about the design when you go out to sample, a few of the things that you're going to make sure you do is make sure that you're looking at areas of observed contamination that are located on the same property and that they're within 200 feet of either a residence, a school, a daycare center, or a workplace area. Or if the area of observed contamination is within the boundaries of a resource, which is defined by HRS, or if it is within a terrestrial sensitive environment. when you're looking at sampling for waste characteristics, you'll remember for soil exposure, those factors are toxicity and then the hazardous waste quantity. So in the soil exposure pathway, we are evaluating the areas of observed contamination. We're not evaluating the sources at this point. We're only those areas of observed contamination. And then again, our targets in the soil exposure pathway includes the resident population threat. So these are the residences, the schools, daycares, workplaces, sensitive environments, and the resources. And then it also includes the nearby populations that are within 1 mile. So when we're looking at establishing observed contamination in the soil exposure pathway, we must have analytical data, and this analytical data must show one attribution. So it must show that the contamination is attributable back to the site and that the contamination also exists at significant levels, so that it exists above what we would consider background. If in the soil exposure pathway we're not able to show observed contamination by direct observation like we are in the other pathways, we cannot do that in the soil exposure pathway. That's why we need to have the analytical data that documents that we do have contamination in that area of contamination, and it's present at the significant levels. If we cannot establish observed contamination through the analytical data, then we would not evaluate this pathway, the soil exposure pathway. So when we're sampling to establish observed contamination, we want to make sure that we're sampling to identify what our resident population targets are. A minimum of 3 samples should be collected to estimate your area of observed contamination. And then you can collect 1 sample from an other source type, again, to demonstrate the attribution. You also want to remember that for the soil exposure pathway, HRS says that the samples need to be collected within 2 feet of the surface. So you're collecting superficial soil samples. If it's covered by asphalt or concrete or some kind of impenetrable material, you would not want to sample in that location. You want to sample where there is, you know, dirt covered or grass covered, where the material could have soaked into, could have migrated onto that area, and that it doesn't have a cap on it, such as asphalt or concrete. Most of the time when you're sampling in this pathway, it will be it'll be surface soil samples that you're collecting, but depending on your site, you could be collecting actual source material if that's what's covering the ground and within the top 2 feet of the surface. It could also maybe be sediment if there's been some runoff, if there's drainage ditches around the site. It could be more of a sediment type material instead of an actual soil. So again, when we are sampling, to identify which of our targets have been exposed to this contamination that's in the superficial soil, so within that top 2 feet from the surface. And we want to sample in the direction of the targets. So we want to make sure that we're sampling in the way that the targets would be coming to that area of observed contamination. We want to try to document any kind of observed contamination that is within the property boundaries of, again, residences, schools, daycares, or workplaces, or the boundary of a terrestrial sensitive environment or a resource. And then again, we want to just remember that the most important analytical for the soil exposure pathway are samples that establish observed contamination and level of contamination. So we want to be collecting samples that show that we that document an area of observed contamination, so contamination is present, and that it's at levels of contamination that are elevated in above our above background. When we're thinking about our targets again, we want to make sure that we are considering the targets that are on the property, the contamination that's on the property, and again within the 200 feet of the residence, school, or workplace, or within the boundary of a resource or a sensitive environment. We also need to think about evaluating the level of contamination. So the level of contamination, it needs to be evaluated for each resident, daycare, school, or workplace property. In the soil exposure pathway, for purposes of the HRS scoring process, you can infer contamination between two points of observed contamination based on your site conditions. So you can infer that contamination. You can also infer contamination between two sampling points. So if you have two sampling points, you can also infer that that contamination exists between those two locations as long as you have elevated levels at both of those sampling points and the contaminants that are there are attributed back to the site. You should, though, if you even if you are inferring contamination, you want to try to delineate the area to the best of your abilities and then comparing your concentration levels to benchmarks like we do all the time. So, again, those soil benchmarks, they're in Skidham. Those are the ones that should be used. And then what you're going to do with those benchmarks, like we've talked about before, is you're going to determine if you have level one or level two actual contamination. So just like before, to have level one contamination, you need to have an area of contamination that equals or either exceeds its benchmarks. So if you have that, you can establish level one. If you have a concentration of a contaminant that is below a benchmark in Skidham, but it's still greater than three times background concentrations, then that establishes level two contamination for that area. You should know that if you are going to infer contamination between two sampling points or two points of observed contamination, then that will be evaluated at level two contamination. So again, talking a little bit more about inferring contamination, as I mentioned, the population that's associated with that area of inferred contamination can only be evaluated as level two targets. At some times, you might need to refine your area of contamination based on new criteria that might be developed from a new site visit or from analytical data. So you want to make sure that you're evaluating your area of contamination properly. An example that we give is if you have an area where a hazardous substance had been spilled. If there are areas that were originally included in your area of observed contamination that were at a higher elevation than where the spill occurred, you would want to reassess that and modify because your spill, if it's at a lower elevation, is not going to travel upwards to the higher elevation. So that would be an instance where you might need to refine your original area of contamination. And then you can use non-analytical data. So that could be things if you have data that was that you got out of another investigation that occurred at the site, or if you have some documentation on the way that waste was disposed of at the site. If you can find a pattern that there's some distressed vegetation, that's another type of non-analytical data, or any kind of topographic or drainage maps that you might be able to obtain for the site. You can use those, and that type of data can be used to infer an area of observed contamination as well. And then as far as background samples, usually, you know, these should represent what the uncontaminated areas around your site. So you want to make sure that they are collected from an undisturbed area. You want to make sure that they are collected also at the same time as your samples that you're collecting to document and observe contamination samples. So they want to be done in the same sampling event, usually within 1 to 3 days of each other. But definitely during the same sampling event, you want to collect your background samples. So here's just a little table that we've put together that just gives you some things to think about when you're going out there. As we mentioned, the primary objective for in the soil exposure pathway for sampling during the SI is just to document that the targets have been exposed to hazardous substances that, again, can be attributed back to your site sources. Your data quality should be rigorous, like always. You know, this data will be used to hopefully move forward in the process and start the HRS scoring process. So you want to make sure that your data quality is good, that you're following procedures, you're collecting QC samples to document that you properly collected everything. Typically, the average number of samples is it can be anywhere from 1 to 20. This can range, too, just based on, you know, project budgets and what your focus is for the sampling event. Types of activities during this, so you would want to sample source and target areas within the top 2 feet of the surface. You would want to sample residential areas that have not been sampled yet. And then also you'd want to collect some samples from properties where concentrations are near your benchmarks. So again, so that you have something to compare your observed contamination samples to. For background, you know, it says as many as necessary. You would want to try to, I think, at least get 3 background samples if possible. If not, then at least, you know, 1 to 2 background samples so that you can compare those again to your observed contamination samples. You also would want to make sure that you could use aerial photographs to help with that, to see where you have some areas that might be a good place to collect some background samples as well. And then again, an attribution sample. So that's just to show that your hazardous substances can be attributed back to your site. And then again, the QAQC samples, so you'd want to have a duplicate, a blank sample. You'd also want to make sure that this meets the requirements of your region that you're working in. So they might have specific QAQC samples that need to be done or the frequency that they need to be done with. Maybe there's, you know, one region that wants, you know, a duplicate every 5 samples. Instead of every 10 samples or something like that. So you want to make sure you know what your regional guidance is for collecting QAQC samples. So some of the common problems that we come across in the soil exposure pathway when we're sampling, cross-contamination is one of the issues that we come across. This is just making sure that the sample that you collected at that specific location represents the soil at that specific location. So this is where you're going to want to make sure that the people in the field that are collecting the samples are following the proper procedures, both for collection, for handling the samples, for packaging the samples, as well as doing any kind of decon. Preferably, it would be nice to use, you can reduce some of this by using disposable sampling equipment, but if that is not possible, then you, or if it's a regional guideline that you cannot use disposable equipment, you'd want to, again, just make sure that your field personnel has everything that they need to do the proper decon in between sample locations, that they know to do decon between sample locations and that they're following, you know, the proper procedures. Some of the other issues or problems that come up with soil sampling, making sure that you are collecting comparable samples. So if you want to make sure that if you're collecting composite samples, that's what you're collecting, and the composite samples are being compared to the composite samples, not a composite sample compared to a grab sample. So composites to be compared with other composite samples, and the grab samples should be compared to other grab samples. You also want to try to make sure that the samples are as homogeneous as possible. You know, also that you are trying to get similar soil types, and that they're also collected from the same depth so that they can be easily compared to each other. And then for the background samples, again, you should also collect these. These should be off-site samples. You could also use results if there's a site that's nearby. You could also use results from other site investigations that have been done. Or you could also use literature values. You know, some counties and states have data online that shows the background for maybe not all chemicals, but a lot of hazardous substances in their area, and you could look that up and use that if you're not able to collect background samples. So we have a little table here. This is actually out of the HRF guidance manual, and it's highlight 9-1, and it just gives you an idea of your different types of sources and then what background samples you would collect from those. In order for when you have areas of observed contamination. So you can see for contaminated soil, you would want to do your best to collect the background samples from soil that's in vicinity of the site. That's the same for landfills and piles, as well as surface impoundments that have either been backfilled or are composed of mainly sludge material. You'll notice for tanks and drums, if they are filled with contaminated soil, then that would be the same. You would want to get your background sample. You'd want to collect soil in the vicinity of the site. If it's a tank or drum that contains liquid or solid waste, you don't have a background sample for those. That's just zero. So this just gives you an idea of kind of what to think of when you are sampling. So here is our little case study example that we have for you. I'm going to go ahead and go to the figure so you can follow along while I'm telling you what's at the site. So this is the Carbeth landing site. It is a dump that's, of course, near a residential area. Here's your residential area. It's also by an elementary school. So your site is right in this area. There was dumping that occurred at this site. We don't know for how long, and it was alleged that what was dumped there were paints, both organic and inorganic substances, and then a lot of construction debris. There's no type of vegetation observed at the site, and the sources that you have are some containers. So you have some 5-gallon containers. And then there's two areas of stained soil that are both pretty poorly defined areas of stained soil. You have the Pigeon River, which is about 400 feet east of the site. And this Pigeon River has flooded the Carbeth landing site 2 times in the past 7 years. And during the preliminary assessment investigation, it was concluded that they think that the flooding could have carried hazardous substances onto the adjacent school property and then also into the residential properties. And the hazardous substances that are associated with this Carbeth landing site are not known. However, just based on what was allegedly dumped at the site, it most likely is metals that would typically be found in paint materials. So we'll in phase one, we're going to do a focused SI soil sampling strategy. And so what we're going to do in this one is we're going to collect about 14 samples during this focused SI. And what we're going to do is we're going to collect some samples from the residential area. So we're going to do about 3 samples right here, those that are closest to the actual site. And we're going to collect those to see if our populations, we're also collect 2 from the nearby school. We're going to collect these to see if our populations, so if those at the school and those at these 3 residential properties, have been exposed to a hazardous substance. We also want to, for the residential areas and the school area, some of the non-sampling data that we would like to obtain is the number of people per residence, the number of students that attend the elementary school, and then also the number of teachers and then other staff members that work at the school as well. We're also going to collect some background soil samples. So this is represented by SS7 and SS8 on the figure. And again, this is to determine what our levels of hazardous substances are at the site. So these will hopefully be representative of natural conditions or what the site conditions are. So we'll be able to compare those to our 2 samples collected at the school and our 3 samples collected at the residence to determine if we are above background levels. And then we're also going to collect some surface soil samples from our source areas. So we're going to collect about 6 of those. As you can see, we're going to do about 4 of them from this area of contamination where we have the containers, and then we're also going to collect 2 surface soil samples over here from our other area of stained soils that we have. So again, these samples are being collected to identify what hazardous substances we have at the site, and then to see if we do have, if the PA hypothesis was correct, that we do have surficial soil contamination in these 2 areas. And you'll remember in these areas we're not collecting any samples to try to increase our waste quantity factor. You'll remember when you're dealing with soil, the divisor is extremely high. I think it's 34,000 if I remember correctly. So in here, you know, we're not collecting these to try to necessarily increase the waste quantity level, because it would take a lot of contaminated, you know, soil to do that. We're just mainly looking to see if we do, what hazardous substances we do have, and then what they are and what the concentrations are. Some of the non-analytical data that we would want to collect in these areas is just what are the physical dimensions of the stained soil, to try to get a better estimate on the stained soil extent. And then we'd also want to get a count of the 5-gallon paint containers that are there. How many are there? Are there any labels on them? What do the labels say? What do they indicate might be present in the paint pails? And then, of course, we're going to be collecting some quality control samples. These are not labeled on here, but again, this is just to make sure that we're collecting these to make sure that we're getting the best data quality that we can, to make sure that our field personnel did follow correct sampling procedures and also proper decon procedures. So this is, you know, the QC samples are just collected to ensure that everything was done properly and that the data is of good quality and can be used to make decisions about the site. So that was in our phase one. Those are the samples that we proposed to collect. And then in phase two, this is going to be our expanded SI soil sampling strategy. So when we go out for phase two, this is what we would recommend collecting. We would collect some additional surface soil samples from the residential areas. So again, this is to document that we do have residential targets and to evaluate each one of them on their level of contamination. So are they at level one or are they at level two actual contamination? And I'll go ahead and go to the map so you can see where we're collecting these from. So these new samples from the residential areas are documented with the XS label. And then we have 7, 8, 9, and then also 11 back over at the school property. And then the rest of these 12 through, I believe it's 17, in the residential area. So those would be our additional residential samples that we would collect. Again, this is just to, we're doing this to establish observed contamination on both the residential properties and the school property. And then other things, some non-sampling data, again, is just to confirm the number of residents that are affected to determine what the property boundaries should be. And then also, again, just to confirm the number of students at the school and then the number of teachers and other staff members that work at the school. We're also going to collect some additional background samples for this one. We're going to collect XS3 through 6. So on the northern portion of the site, we'll collect those four as background samples. And then we're also going to collect one additional background sample on the other side of the Pigeon River, number 10, to just document what our conditions are over there. So again, we're just looking to document these to show that we do have, to show if we do have target contamination and to show that it's attributable to the site, that hopefully our levels are above background. And then just again to ensure that we have enough background samples collected for HRS scoring purposes and documentation package purposes. And then again, we'll collect our QA, QC samples just like we did before to ensure that we have, that we followed the proper procedures and that we can use this data in the HRS. If we move on to the HRS scoring process, we can use the data is usable because it was collected properly. So to kind of end the soil exposure pathway sampling strategies, we just have a couple slides here with a few pictures. And really what we're just trying to show here is that, you know, most of the time when you're sampling, especially in these kind of conditions, you're going to be close to residential properties. So that's one thing that you'll want to keep in mind, making sure that you have access to be collecting samples on the property. We've talked about that before. You must have that in writing. Remember, as always, if you get it verbally, then you definitely want to follow up immediately with getting it in writing as well. Also, just to know, why be able to tell, you know, the residents why you are sampling, what the purpose is, what kind of chemicals you're sampling for, if they're going to see results. These are all types of questions that, you know, a resident might ask if you're sampling on or very near to their own property. And then also, you want to make sure that that you have a way to hopefully obtain a sample that is not influenced by other contamination that might be at the residence. So, for example, if you're sampling near older homes, you might run into a situation where they still have lead paint. You know, you want to try to think about things like that and try to do your best to collect the samples from areas where you may not be influenced by things such as that are not site related but might be residentially related. So that pretty much sums up the soil exposure pathway sampling strategies. Remember, it's an exposure pathway, it's not a migration pathway. And our primary objective is to identify if we have contamination on residential, school, daycare, or workplace property. So if we have contamination on our targets, remember you cannot have observed contamination by direct observation in the soil exposure pathway. So documenting observed contamination requires analytical data. So you have to have analytical data. The soil exposure pathway is one pathway where you can infer sampling, or I'm sorry, you can infer contamination between areas of observed contamination as well as between two sampling locations. But remember, if you are inferring contamination, that those targets will then can only be subject to level two actual contamination. And then again, just remembering that you need to always demonstrate attribution to show that those hazardous substances that your targets are contaminated with is attributable back to your site. So that takes us to the end of the soil exposure pathway. So I guess if there are any questions that came in, we can take those now.
Okay. So just a reminder, you all can submit your comments and questions into the Q&A window, which appears in the lower right-hand corner. I do have one question that came in, and we'll wait to see if a few others pop up in the Q&A window. But this first one that was submitted actually asked, what happens if your background sample comes back high?
I assume that means if it's higher than what you're...
Yeah, I think maybe we can look at it, you know, from two different ways. If you got a background sample and it's higher than you expected, and then perhaps higher than your contaminated samples are coming back, what would you do in those two circumstances?
Right. So if you have a background that is higher than what you had anticipated, that can easily happen. I mean, you might have an area where, you know, the only soil around your site or in the vicinity of your site is, you know, maybe fill material. That's a good example. And so that may have, you know, higher levels of contamination than you thought it might. But that is representative, if that's what is in the vicinity of your site, that is representative of, you know, background conditions then, and you would use that to compare to your samples that you collected to document and observed contamination. If you have a background sample that is higher than your observed contamination sample,
Well, I guess I would evaluate why. I mean, maybe you took the background in the wrong location, and that's why, you know, they strongly suggest that you do more than one background sample. So you would really try to figure out why. Maybe that's really not a background location, and maybe that's really establishes another area of contamination or extends an area of contamination. And then hopefully if you took additional background samples, you would not have the same problem with those. Your other options are to sample again and try to get in an area that is truly background, or as a measure of last resort, you could try to use literature values if you are in an area where you can't find a representative background.
Okay, perfect. That's exactly what the participant went on to clarify. Just how do you know that you haven't hit another source of contamination? And I think you just summed that up perfectly. We do have another question. This participant asks, can the upland soil, in other words, the former riverbank, be used as background for permanently exposed sediments for now wetland mudflats following a dam removal? And I can read that one out.
Yeah.
So in a situation... Yeah. Where we have a former riverbank, can you use upland soil as background for permanently exposed sediments, which are now wetland mudflats? and this is in an area where they removed a dam.
I am not sure. And that is one that I would run by your regional NPL coordinator to determine what in that case would be an acceptable background. It's possible it would be, but I can't answer, you know, absolutely that it would, that you would be able to use them.
Okay. All right. Don't see any other questions coming into the queue at the moment. If the participant who just asked that one has further clarifications, you're certainly welcome to send that in, and we'll see if we can come back to that during our next question break. Participants can continue to type up their questions or comments, and we'll take another break in just a little bit once we work on our next section. So if it's okay with you guys, Therese, feel free to carry on.
All right. I just want to add one more thing on soil, since it's something to look for in the future. Right now in Skidham, there is no lead benchmark. So sites that are evaluated in the soil exposure pathway for lead contamination can only use level 2. EPA has been working on getting a soil lead benchmark so that level 1 could be evaluated. And in fact, earlier in the year, a lead value appeared in Skidham for soil and then was quickly removed as they are rethinking it. So be on the lookout for the addition of that lead soil benchmark because you may be in a position to reevaluate sites that, you know, didn't score on level 2 but may have scored, may have raised the pathway score and then the site score if you could have scored using level 1 for lead. So be on the lookout for that in the future. And it, you know, when that lead number appeared in Skidham, there was no big fanfare. It just appeared. So I would go ahead and check Skidham often and look at the update. They always have a little note on when it was last updated. And so whenever it's updated, I would check the lead benchmark levels. All right, let's talk about the air migration pathway. This is the least scored pathway. Only 7% of sites on the NPL use the air pathway, but sometimes it's the only pathway that can be scored, and for those sites, it's good to know how to do it. So let's talk about some of these SI sampling strategies. Hopefully, after I get through with this module, you would be able to identify the important HRS considerations for this particular pathway and the sampling that occurs in this pathway. It is the most complicated pathway to sample. It's also probably the most expensive pathway to sample. Therefore, you really need to understand all of the considerations. There's also, you should also be able to list the contaminant characteristics that you should understand when you're sampling this pathway. You should be able to describe how observed releases can be documented and some of the target considerations that are unique to the air migration pathway. Also describe, in general, air sampling considerations. After taking this little module, you won't be in a position to go sample the air pathway. You'll probably still need help if you've never done it before from folks that have, but you'll get an idea of some of the general considerations that you need to pay attention to. And then I'll talk a little bit about some of the common problems and issues that come up when you're sampling this pathway. And we'll end with a little case study example that we've just taken completely from the site inspection guidance. So for this pathway, we're looking at getting points for our pathway score from those three factor categories. This one represents the likelihood of release, waste characteristics, and targets. And the air pathway has some unique features that I'll point out to you. So you can document an observed release either by direct observation or by using sampling data. And the air pathway allows direct observation if you can actually see the contamination. So mainly it's related to the types of air contaminants that are visible, such as particulates. And then photographic documentation is required if you are going to rely on direct observation. Otherwise, you would be using sampling data. And here are some of the considerations that you should think about before running out and setting up a complicated air sampling program. First of all, you really need to assess the likelihood of being able to detect airborne contamination. The air is a large diluter. And so, and it's very expensive to sample it. So you want to make sure that you have the sorts of conditions at your site where you reasonably expect to detect airborne contamination. And that relates in part to the chemical properties of the contaminants in your sources. So do you have gases, or is it mainly particulates, or contaminants that can be actually both a gas and a particulate? You want to look at the particle size of any airborne particulates that you're examining. Particle size will affect how far that particle may travel in the air. You'll also want to think about your sources and whether or not they are contained or covered, and are actually able to release contaminants to the air. And then look at prevailing wind direction and speed when you're setting up a sampling system. And then the sort of precipitation that the area receives, usually on an annual basis. That affects mainly particulate mobility in the HRS world, with drier areas or more arid areas having a greater particulate mobility than areas that receive a lot of precipitation. All right, and I'll talk about some of all of these a little bit as we move on. So when you're thinking about the waste characteristics, you will want to have an understanding of the inhalation toxicity of the contaminants of concern at your site. The higher the inhalation toxicity, the greater your waste characteristic score would be. And depending on the toxicity of the characteristics, toxicity characteristics of the contaminants you have, that might influence whether or not you go forward with sampling this pathway. You'll be looking at the mobility of both your gaseous and your particulate contaminants. You'll get higher mobilities for gases than particulates. And then, again, the likelihood of detecting your site contaminants through sampling, considering distance from sources, what is releasing from those sources, and the fact that the contaminants are diluted in the atmosphere to a great degree. Now, the air pathway is a little unique in that no direct sampling of specific air migration pathway targets is necessary. It's very different from the groundwater pathway. Remember, in the groundwater pathway, if you're going to count a well as a target well, you must sample that target well. However, in the air pathway, what you do is you sample within your target distance limit. And if you can establish and observe release to the air pathway through sampling in that target distance limit, you get to count all the targets you can find within that target distance limit and any target distance limits closer into the site. So if you establish a release and observe contamination in the, let's say, the half-mile target distance limit, then you get everything from all targets from the half-mile into the site, including the quarter mile where you actually didn't collect a sample. So that's one advantage of the air migration pathway. The TDLs for the air migration pathway are the same as they are for groundwater, so it's 4 miles divided into quarter mile, half mile, mile, 2 mile, 3 mile, 4 mile. So there's actually 6 targets that you draw. And then you can use air emission models to guide your decision making to determine where best to collect your sample, where you would expect that contamination might have migrated. Air emission models can be useful to do that. All right, so let's go back and talk a little bit more about this observed release by direct observation. So sometimes you can see contaminants visually being released into the air, and here we have a little photograph of that occurring. If this were happening at your site, you would want to make sure you collect photographic evidence. You would take a picture of that, and then you would get some analytical evidence to confirm that there are hazardous substances in this actual source here. And that can include existing data, soil or source samples that you collect during the site inspection, or waste manifests. As long as this information is strong enough to through QAQC to be included in your site inspection. You should also look for facility records or historical records of local health and environmental agencies for documentations of air releases. Usually, if a facility has had a history of air releases, you may be able to find information that an air release has occurred and a worker was injured, for example. And that worker was taken to the hospital, and it's documented that they were exposed to a hazardous substance that was released into the air at the facility. That is enough to establish an observed release by direct observation. There's an example that we bring to our HRS course, a data package for a facility, where an EPA RCRA inspector was conducting his RCRA inspection. And at the same time, there was a release of chlorine gas at the facility, and the RCRA inspector was exposed, had to be taken to the hospital. It was a rather serious exposure. This person could not do field work anymore. Chlorine gas is very detrimental to your lungs. But this event was enough to establish the observed release by direct observation. And because the facility was large and had about 400 workers at it, that was enough to to give a big target score also when they were counting the targets. So it helped with the likelihood of release and giving them the full 550 points. And then within the target counting, they were able to count all 400 workers at the facility. So make sure you look for those sorts of incidents, especially if your particular site or facility has a history of air releases. So here's the big question. Because air sampling is expensive, you really need to decide when air samples should be collected. So if you're out there conducting your preliminary assessment and you suspect that air releases are of an immediate health concern, that would be a good reason to conduct air sampling. So this is really not related solely to your HRS score. Now you're a risk manager, and you're going to recommend that air sampling be conducted because the potential air releases are an immediate health concern. The air migration pathway is also further usually sampled when it's solely responsible or it's the only pathway available to present a site score that would get the site on the national priorities list. So if it's the only pathway, then certainly, and when you run your numbers, you think it could score, then you would definitely want to sample in that case. When the air migration pathway score is necessary to elevate an overall site score, so maybe you're scoring two pathways, and if you could just bump up the air migration pathway score a bit, then you would have a site score above 28.50. That's also another reason. However, in general, it's futile to try to add points to your low scoring pathways, and especially if those pathways have an original score of 10 or less. So be careful about that one and really run your numbers and your scenarios to make sure that bumping up an existing score would get you anything in terms of 28.5 for the overall site score. So during the SI, when any of these above conditions are true, you would recommend sampling. And usually the air migration pathway is screened in the first phase of the SI, and then that screening data is used to determine whether or not sort of a full-blown air sampling approach should be used in a more focused or expanded SI. So background is also an attribution, is also a big concern in the air migration pathway. And when you are collecting your background and your release samples, you want to make sure that you're using similar collection methods and they're in similar analytical technologies. So you're going to want to set up your sampling stations, collecting samples from the same, from the breathing zone in both the background and the release samples. You want to pull the same volume of air through the sampler in both your background and your release samples. You want to conduct that sampling during the same time frame. This is very important, and it's another reason why in the air pathway you are recommended to take more than one background, set up more than one background station. You'll also want to likely do both upwind and crosswind samples. These samples are usually collected for a minimum of 12 hours, and the wind direction can change in that 12 hours, and therefore a crosswind sample could now become a release sample. So in order to account for changing wind direction that could occur over the long sampling time that you need for the air sampling program, multiple stations, both upwind and crosswind, are recommended. And then rigorous QAQC is required. If you are in a situation where, let's say, a potentially responsible party might object to, you know, getting their site placed on the NPL, it is very likely that they will attack your sampling methodology to try to say that you've not proved you have an observed release or that it is not attributable to their site. So you need to sort of nail down all of those issues and then make sure that you follow the protocols you put in place so that your data can't be questioned. It'll still be questioned, but you'll have answers to those questions. Here's just a few examples of some sort of simple stations that were set up. This is pulling both a high and a low volume. You can see these are the actual pumps that are drawing the air, and these are the little sample collectors. And they are set up in the breeding zone about 4 feet off the ground. I think these sample pumps are called aircon 2s that are used to both pull both a low volume and a high volume sample. This is a situation where we have a sampler set up indoors. And indoor air sampling is not appropriate for the air migration pathway. The air samples have to be collected from outside, from ambient air. So this setup, while it may help you assess vapor intrusion concerns, it would not be useful or acceptable for HRS scoring. So it's always outdoor ambient air sampling that is being conducted for a site inspection that leads to a hazard ranking system score. All right, let's talk a little bit about our map here. And then I think we have a poll that is going to come up. Jean, if you could put that poll up if you want to. while I talk about this. And so here we have our site, and we're showing you just through the 2-mile distance ring. Remember, the air pathway does go all the way to the 4-mile distance ring, but we're showing quarter mile, half mile, 1 mile, and 2 mile on this figure. And we have our site located here in the center of the dot. The reason we don't go beyond 2 miles in this photo is because sampling is not recommended outside the 2-mile zone. And it's really recommended that you sample, you set your sampling stations up as close as possible to your sources so that you have a greater likelihood of detecting some contaminants. So if an observed release is demonstrated, let's say you got really lucky and you demonstrated it in your half mile, then you would be able to count all the targets from the half mile, quarter mile, half mile, which is this, all the way in to the site. If you set up a sampler at the 1 mile and you got really lucky and were able to say you had an observed release in the 1 mile, you would get all targets located in this all the way from the 1 mile all the way into the site, including those that are both crosswind and upwind. So it's just like groundwater. We look at all targets that are within that radius, and that includes targets that could be upgradient of your site. So same thing for air. You don't need to go sample at the school. You don't need to sample at any individual homes. Just a sample that establishes an observed release within the TDL, you get to count all targets within that TDL and towards the site. The guidance strongly recommends that you probably focus on the quarter mile TDL for sampling. The closer you are to your sources, the more likely you are to actually detect contaminants in the samplers. Now, a few words about targets. In the air pathway, they include, you get points for the nearest individual, and that is the nearest regularly occupied building. It could be a resident, a residence, a school, or a workplace. And then for the population, you count all residents, folks who go to school, and workers within your TDLs of concern. You would also look at resources within a half a mile of your sources. And this is a little difference in this pathway than other pathways. In the groundwater pathway, you got to look at resources within your 4-mile TDL. For the air pathway, they limit it to the half mile TDL. Those resources include commercial agriculture, commercial silviculture, and major or designated recreation areas. And you get 5 points or 0 points. So either you have these resources or you don't. And then you also can score sensitive environments that occur within the 4-mile TDL. And they get scored either as actual targets or potential targets. In the actual targets, there is no level 1 or level 2 breakdown, and there is no multiplier. So there, or the multiplier is 1. So they're scored sort of like level 2 contamination. But if you establish an observed release and you have, let's say, a critical habitat like this within your TDL, and you establish your observed release in this TDL, then you get to count that whole critical habitat. And those are the same critical habitats that are on, I think it's table 4-23, but I could be wrong. But it's that same table that we've looked at many times that gives a point value, a description of what the sensitive environment is, and then a point value. Critical habitats get 100 points. And then for wetlands, you also take a look at wetlands. And wetlands are divisible, so you would look at only that portion of a wetland that is within the TDL where you have an observed release.
Uh-oh.
I'm just waiting for my slides to come back. Ah, okay, we got this, our poll is up here now. So, based on this scenario and everything I just said, or maybe you guys could see the poll and I couldn't. It's possible. All right, the majority of you
are
answering
voting,
this.
Yes.
Yeah, they're answering this correctly. So the correct answer is wetlands, schools, critical habitat, and the 120 people that we've identified within this zone. And we're looking at the 1 mile distance ring and inward to the site. So that's these 80 and 40 people. And then we have our critical habitat and our wetlands. Oops, our critical habitat and our wetlands. So you would be able to count all of these wetlands from the 1 mile into the site. The school would also count. All right, good job on that one. So some general considerations for your air sampling efforts. You want to make sure you collect your air samples either before or after your other media sampling. So you may be also sampling the soil to establish areas of observed contamination. You would want to make sure nobody's out there mucking up the soil with sampling so that it couldn't be called into question that your own sampling caused the release and the release was not just caused by normal conditions. You want to make sure you use the same air sampling volume for all sampling stations, both all of your release stations and all of your background stations. You want to collect continuous meteorological data while your samples are being collected. We recommend that you set up little met stations at each one of your air sampling stations. Normally you'd be measuring wind speed and wind direction, temperature, and barometric pressure. And you'll also want to know if you have a precipitation event while you're collecting your air samples, because that would impact what you're going to find in your air samples. So this photo shows that they have their sampling station set up. They are collecting their air sample from the breeding zone, and then they have this meteorological station that's set up and that's providing a readout and collecting data continuously during the sampling period. So this is really a do not. You want to make sure that you're not collecting your air samples near facilities that are also discharging into air and that could affect both your release and your background samples. You may need more than one sampling event. It's possible that a single sampling event might get messed up by changing weather conditions while you're conducting your sampling event, and you'll have to go out and possibly repeat it. Remember, you should be collecting your samples for at least 12 hours, and if you want to establish level 1 actual contamination for lead in the air, then you would need a 24-hour sample. Some of the common problems that are seen for the air sampling pathway is putting the air monitoring stations in inappropriate locations. For instance, don't put your air sampling station on the roof of a building. That is really not the breeding zone. They really should be located in the breeding zone about 4 feet from the ground. Also, there may be problems from attribution if you have interferences from other facilities. So if you're in an area where you have other discharges to the air, the same contaminants that you're interested in, attribution is going to be an issue that you'll have to resolve and that may take more than one sampling event. Even though the air, especially particulates that move through the air, definitely land somewhere, it is not appropriate to use dust or wipe samples from where you think that air-transported contaminant might have landed. You might use dust or wipe sampling to inform whether or not you had an air released to the air, but those dust and wipe samplings are not used in your scoring. Soil samples are also not used to document and observe release in the air pathway, although, again, aerial deposition can lead to a soil problem, and understanding how your contaminants got to the soil informs your soil sampling approach, not necessarily your air sampling approach. Soil gas surveys do not provide the level of quality or data that is needed for HRS, so you would not use a soil gas survey results for the air sampling pathway. In addition, sample results from a PID or a FID, a photoionization detector or a flame ionization detector, do not provide the quality of data needed for scoring, but they may be used as a screening in the initial or focused SI to determine whether or not the air pathway should be sampled. All of these things, precipitation and high and low barometric pressure, may affect your sampling results. So if those changes to those, if you get a precipitation event while you're sampling, or you get fluctuations in barometric pressure from high to low during your sampling, air sampling, it may affect your sampling results. You should understand before you go out what those effects might be, and so that when you get your data, you can explain why it doesn't look how it might have you expected it to look. And then air releases in closed structures are not considered observed releases. So here we have this drum, which is obviously releasing something into the air, but it's within a closed building. So you wouldn't take a picture of this, and you wouldn't try to use any air data from this particular release for the air pathway. However, this is a situation that you would want to report if you observed it during a site inspection. This would definitely be something you would not mess around with. You would probably refer that directly to the EPA removal program for immediate attention. All right, let's look at our case study example. It's called the Vega Ore site. It's a remote site, so I imagine it's out west, and mainly because it appears to be associated with mining. And it's near this little place called Small Town, and their ore was processed obtaining lead, zinc, and silver, and that has occurred since the 1930s. However, currently the site activities are limited. And you'll see when we look at the map, we have three sources, three tailings piles, a drum storage area for acids, and an above-ground storage tank. Our nearest resident is only 1,000 feet from the tailings pile. The little place of Small Town relies on drinking water from an intake 3 miles away. And when surface water is more than 2 miles away, it is usually not going to be scored. And you can see down here with this bullet, the surface water body is more than 2 miles away, and so you would not even score the surface water pathway for this particular site. However, you do have some sensitive environments. You've got a national park located 900 feet from the site. And then in terms of groundwater, there are 6 ranches in the quarter-mile distance ring, and they rely on bottled water and cisterns for drinking water. And so there are no groundwater targets. So in this case, it really looked like the air pathway was the only pathway really viable to score for this particular site. So here's our map. We have our three tailings piles, our tank, and our drum storage area. This is our nearest residence. You can see we have a few other residents located around. Here is Small Town, and here is the National Park. Our prevailing wind direction is from west to east. And so with all of this in mind, they devised a sampling strategy. First of all, acknowledging that the air is the only pathway that really could be affecting people and sensitive environment targets, they planned their SI. They plan to sample the air for particulates. They're going to focus on that quarter-mile distance ring, and they're going to collect background. And then also they're going to collect source samples to prove up attribution. The air sample collection should last for at least 12 hours, but since they are looking for lead also, they would run those samples for 24 hours in order to be able to establish level 1 lead contamination in the air pathway. You need to consider wind direction, wind speed, air temperature, and other meteorological conditions when establishing the sampling locations, and then continuously monitor those meteorological conditions while the sampling is being conducted. So here this table came right out of the site inspection guidance. They have their release and target samples, our air sample 4, 5, and 6, and they wanted to determine the presence of and the levels of contaminants and then monitor their MET conditions. They are going to focus on the quarter-mile distance ring. They believe that is will provide the best opportunity to detect an observed release. And then the non-sampling data they're going to collect is to determine the population of a small town that lies within the quarter-mile distance ring, the number of workers still at the site, and then confirm the boundaries of the state park and where it lies in relation to the quarter-mile distance ring. They also have two additional samples that they say support for release and air targets. These are crosswind samples. They're going to put those samples there in an effort to determine if other sources exist that they have not yet identified, maybe a soil contamination source. They're doing it in case wind direction changes. So right now they're crosswind, but during their 24-hour sampling period, they could become downwind and could become release samples themselves. And again, they're looking at the quarter-mile distance ring. So they're going to put those crosswind samples within that quarter-mile distance ring. They're going to collect three background samples, and that's to determine the background levels in the ambient air. You know, frankly, I've tried to figure out what this means, determine background soil levels. Maybe they're also going to, I just don't understand what that means. I think it might be a typo. I don't know why you would want to establish background soil levels when you're doing air sampling. They also want to look at the relative levels of the particulate hazardous substances in the ambient air so they can establish background conditions and then be able to say whether or not they have these particulates in the ambient air, what that background might be, so that they can compare that to their release samples to see if they have a significant increase, which is three times above background. They also are doing three background samples, not just one. In addition, it's possible that A7 and A8 could also be background samples if you don't get a wind shift while you're actually taking the samples. Some of the non-sampling data they're going to collect is to try to identify any other sources at the site and then collect descriptive information for all the background samples, where they're being collected, what lies upwind of them. And then they're going to sample the sources. So one sample for each of the sources. There's the three waste tailings piles, the drum. They're going to sample soil around the drum storage area and some soil around the big tank they have, the above-ground tank. They're sampling to confirm that they have hazardous substances within their sources. They are not trying to increase the HWQ. It doesn't. It is not useful for them because none of their values lie close enough to break points to make a difference. But they will collect some non-sampling data. They'll obtain the physical dimensions of each of those sources, of the tailings piles. They'll confirm the number of drums. They'll also should confirm any containment for those particular sources. And then they have four quality control samples that are being collected. So let's look at where these lie on the map. So the first thing you'll notice is that we have this kind of lumpy quarter-mile distance ring. And that's because they have drawn their quarter-mile distance ring around all of their sources and then combined them together. So that's why it's not a perfect circle. And in cases where you have multiple sources at a site, some distance from each other, it wouldn't be a perfect circle. So you can see that here are our background samples, 1, 2, and 3. They are upwind of what we suspect to be the major sources, which are these tailings piles. And, you know, sort of good for the site score or the pathway score, bad for the national park and small town, but there are, you know, there is a portion of the national park within the quarter-mile distance ring. If an observed release is established for the quarter-mile distance ring, they get to count the full 100 points for that national park. In addition, there is a portion of small town that is located within the quarter-mile distance ring, and they would be able to count all population associated with that area of small town. And then you have a few homes, including the nearest residence, that falls within the quarter-mile distance ring. You can see the source samples, one per source, and then the crosswind samples, 7 and 8, and then the release samples, A5 located very close to this particular tailings pile, A4 also quite close to the tailings pile. And then they collected A6 actually within the bounds of small town. You know, not a bad idea. They don't absolutely have to have a hit here to count the population there. But it's probably a good idea to let folks know, you know, what is happening actually within the bounds of their town. So if they do establish an observed release, either level 1 or level 2 contamination, this site would probably score based on this pathway alone. You would get either 50 or 45 points for the nearest residence. If you could establish level 1 contamination, you get 50. Level 2 contamination, you would get 45. And then you would be able to count the 100 points for this particular sensitive environment, and then all populations associated with the workers, the residences within these ranches, and then the residents within this area of small town. So the summary for I think this is kind of a summary for the whole thing. So I think I'll go ahead and take questions on the air pathway, and then we'll wrap it up.
Okay. We had a few questions that came in regarding some of the exercises. So one of the earlier exercises where we had the ring and you had people vote on the poll, one of our participants asked, what do you do if you have health concerns? So you've collected more than one sample in your target ring, and the results are not consistent. Some are high, some are acceptable. Could you still count all of your targets within that ring?
Yes. If you have, let's go back to this one. So if you had a sampler here, and a sampler here, and a sampler here, and you only had established an observed release in one of those sampling stations, as long as you can attribute that significant increase to your site, you would be able to count all the targets within that distance ring and all distance rings closer in. So you could set up three stations and only get a hit in one, and you can use that one to establish an observed release for the whole TDL, even though you didn't get hits in the others.
Okay.
We had
another question that came in, and this was going on to the later example that you were just working with. I think it's more a comment than it is a question, so I'm just going to share it. The participant mentions that background soil levels need to be established because your source is the soil in the tailing piles or around the drums.
Okay.
I don't know if you agree, if you disagree, or why the location of the source would influence your need for the background soil level.
I guess to rule out the soil as being the cause of the contaminants in the air sampler. I'm just not sure.
Okay.
I guess I'll buy that explanation. I'm going to have to check with my own NPL coordinator on that one.
Okay. This is also a reminder for any participant that has an additional question or comment. You can continue to submit those in the Q&A window that appears in the lower right corner of your screen. It does look like that those are the only ones that I see in the queue right now, but we can certainly talk through some of those summary concepts, and if any additional questions get typed up, we'll take some time to go through those as well before we close out today.
All right. So, you know, hopefully one of the big messages that you have received after these 9 modules is that you really need to design an SI sampling strategy that maximizes your overall site score in a cost-effective manner. And the simpler way of saying that is don't chase down data, don't spend resources to collect data that really doesn't inform your site score. I mean, it might be nice to know how deep that lagoon is, but do you really need to know in order to change your HWQ? So be very picky about questioning whether or not any particular data that you are going to spend money to collect really informs your site score. And you might need help to do that if you're brand new to conducting site assessments. And one really good resource to help you is the regional MPL coordinator, who should have really good experience, has been looking at a lot of different sites, and has been involved in a number of different scenarios. Now, there's an easy way for you to decide what data you should collect, and that's by making hypotheses and then running them through, sort of in a worst-case scenario, through your QuickScore program in order to decide whether or not it's worth collecting that data. And then also remember that you're not just conducting this work to feed the HRS. I mean, that's a big primary reason why you're doing it. But if you're out there and you're seeing site conditions that, in your opinion, should be addressed immediately, you know, it's incumbent on you to become a risk manager and refer those site conditions to the appropriate authority so that they can be addressed immediately and not just be used to feed the HRS score. So you need to really devise strategies that consider the unique HRS requirements that apply to sources and targets, and then that apply in different ways to each of the pathways that you're evaluating. There are differences between them or among them. So groundwater isn't quite the same as surface water, isn't quite the same as soil exposure, isn't quite the same as air pathway. So you really need to understand what those unique differences are in order to devise an SI sampling strategy that will work for you. And make sure you address all those special considerations. I'm sort of getting a wacky thing happening with my screen there, Jean.
Sure.
All right. So hopefully, here it is. Hopefully we have achieved our objectives here, and you now understand the scope and activities that are conducted for both the PA and the SI, how they're different from one another, that you understand sort of the foundation, the legal and regulatory framework behind the work that you're going to be doing, and the EPA guidance and policies that apply to CERCLA site assessments. And hopefully through these 9 modules, we've given you an opportunity to play around with QuickScore or see us play around with QuickScore using that PA level information, and then through presentations of these short case studies that came from the SI guidance, you can see how to evaluate SI sampling strategies. And now you'll be able to go and explain to someone else what CERCLA site assessments are all about, why they're conducted, when they're conducted, and how they're conducted, and that you yourself are better prepared to plan for and conduct and report out on the results of your preliminary assessment and to put together a preliminary HRS score you can test then in your site inspection. And you're in a better position to assess whether or not a site should move on to a site inspection, what its priority should be, and then plan for conducting that site inspection and reporting out on the results. And that you feel more comfortable using the guidance and the software and the tools that are available to you to meet the requirements for a CERCLA PA and SI and an HRS data package. Just one little note. That when you're playing with QuickScore and you're running scenarios, I've done it myself, it's very easy to overlook changing a number. So I'm, you know, just being in a hurry, you forget to really check and make sure you've changed all the numbers appropriately when you change your scenario. So it's always a good idea to check your own work a couple times and then to have somebody else check your work to make sure that if you shifted from an actual contamination scenario to a potential contamination scenario, that you remember to adjust your nearest individual value. Because, you know, you don't always get 50 there or 45. If you're going with potential, you're going to get a lot less points there. And it's easy to forget when you're using the software program. And then the other thing I want you to look out for, a big change that we're hoping to see is the proposed revision to the HRS model and the HRS rule to incorporate vapor intrusion. As far as I know, that EPA has done its work, and that proposed regulation change is at the Office of Management and Budget, and I don't know if they've started their 90-day clock. But once they start the clock for their review, they have 90 days to review it. And then EPA would, you know, respond to their comments and then propose the new rule or the revisions to the rule in the Federal Register. So be on the lookout for that. That is something that will be new for us in HRS when it does happen. All right. So I really thank you all for hanging in here and participating in this 9-module webinar. We hope it's been useful to you. Please let us know what we could do better for the next time. We really do pay attention to your evaluations, and we wish you all good luck and success in the future as you go out and assess these sites. And that is it.
Okay, excellent. We did have 2 additional questions squeeze in during some of those summary statements. So if you don't mind, since we do have time, I'm going to go ahead and walk through these 2 questions.
Sure.
The first one asked in reference to slide number 45, do you always have background air samples inside the TDL? if you need any help getting back.
I don't think they absolutely have to be inside the TDL. But you want to make sure that they're just representative of background. So if they're outside the TDL, you want to make sure they're not being affected by something, you know, it's sort of off our map. That's upwind.
Okay. And then the next question, if you have a site contaminating or with contaminated groundwater, which then discharges to a stream and the contaminants are being volatilized into the air, can the air pathway can the air exposure pathway be scored?
Wow. I'm not sure about that one. It would have to be a lot of volatilization to be able to detect that in a sampler.
Yeah, and that's what they're saying. If it was volatilized and it was very high, can you then use that air exposure pathway?
Boy, I don't know the answer to that one. I will check with an EPA MPL coordinator and see what they think, and we could post the answer.
Okay.
And there's some folks at headquarters that are really good resources for us, too.
Okay, great. One other participant asked, other than the HRS rule and the HRS guidance document, is there or are there specific or more detailed guidance out there on attribution? It doesn't seem to be as simple as establishing a, quote, joint and several-like situation.
Yeah, as far as I know, if there's a fact sheet, I'm not sure if there's a fact sheet on attribution, but you'd want to check the HRS toolbox on EPA.gov, which has all of the fact sheets that have been published since the PA and SI guidance and the HRS guidance manual were put out. And attribution is important because it's where EPA gets challenged the most. So they're very sensitive to attribution, and sometimes they go beyond what's in the guidance as a current practice. So it's a really good idea to. I don't think there's anything specific to attribution. You'd have to check those HRS fact sheets. Otherwise, it really is talking to folks who have been doing this for a while, to your NPL coordinator, to the QC folks at EPA headquarters. If you are having troubles with attribution or questions about it. It is not like as simple as joint and several. It is more complicated. You know, EPA is very sensitive because they get sued over this, taken to court, and that's really expensive to defend. So that's why QAQC is so important and why, you know, HRS packages undergo such scrutiny.
Okay. Well, I don't see any additional questions or comments, and it does seem like you've walked us through those course conclusions and final reminders. So I can start in our actual seminar series concluding reminders in terms of how to get the materials, how to submit feedback, and access the archives as well. Just before I launch into that, any final statements from either you or Jody?
I don't have anything.
Okay, Jody?
I'm good. Thank you.
All right, excellent. With that, let me go ahead and walk our participants through those final reminders for our CEC Preliminary Assessment and Site Inspection webinar series. I want to thank everyone who was able to join us for both the live and replayed archived versions of these internet sessions. Again, this multi-part seminar series was composed of 9 independent modules. We do have modules 1 through 8 currently available for free replay and download. As registered participants in the series, you should have received unique emails as soon as each one of those modules was posted and made available. Once we get the module 9 archive up, we'll also send out a summary email that has every single one of the archived modules, the link to play it back, and then the feedback link for each one of those available. If you would like to receive a specific training certificate for the entire series, you'll need to be sure to have played back through the recorded version or attended live each one of the modules in the series. And one of the best things you can do is submit feedback for each one of the modules, whether you attended it live or simply watched the recorded version. That feedback form will help us verify your participation in the session. When you fill that feedback form out, you'll want to be sure that you check a box that appears on that feedback form. And as long as your email address is entered correctly and that box is checked, you should receive an automated confirmation email message. If you have any problems with that process, if you don't think the email is coming through, double-check your spam filters or junk box. Sometimes those emails get caught up. And again, if you don't receive them, we can go ahead and try to go in and reissue them to you. There's also an automated lookup tool. If you visit the following page at cluin.org/training and then records, you'll be able to actually enter in your email address, and we'll send you an automated table of all of the webinars that we have listed as being present. If you get that table and it doesn't look complete, what we're recording and sending to you are seminars that we have listed as being present. There are a number of participants who have reported technical problems joining us online and wind up never actually checking in online and simply download the slides and dial in on the phones. And if you just download slides and follow along on the phone lines, we don't have any way to correctly mark you as being present because you don't actually check in online. And therefore, that automated list that gets emailed to you may not look complete. We do send automated emails to all participants that we have marked as not present to double check with you. So if you receive those emails from me and they indicate that we, for some reason, don't have you marked as present, please reply to let us know if you were there. Don't delete those. You can either reply to the email or fill out the form that's embedded in the email, and that will actually correct your participation record with us. And then when you send one of these automated lookup emails to yourself, it will have the correct list of seminars present. Again, if that's confusing or anybody needs any further help documenting their attendance, again, you can certainly email me directly at balance.jean@epa.gov. So we will have all 9 modules archived. You guys will have a period of time to go ahead and replay the modules you may have missed out on and submit feedback for those that you haven't done so. And then in a few weeks, we'll go ahead and start going through our records and automatically emailing participants certificates. It usually takes us about 4 to 6 weeks to start that process. We want to give people enough time to go through and have a chance to catch up on what they missed and then document their attendance. If you haven't received a certificate and you think we may have missed you, you're certainly welcome to email us directly to check on the status of issuing those certificates. Again, I want to thank the over 200 different individuals who have joined us from all over the world throughout the seminar series. I hope you guys found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time and that you'll join us on future webinar series. I also want to thank our very knowledgeable and enjoyable instructors who joined us from Tetra Tech, Inc., Sandra Harrigan, Jody McCarty, and Therese Joya. You guys have done a wonderful job, and we're looking forward to continue to have you on to host future seminars with us. Again, this is the formal conclusion for today's live broadcast of the CEC Preliminary Assessment and Site Inspection Module Number 9.